Senate Bill 826.
Ooh, got a big man in the Senate. Thank you.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman and select members of the committee, my name is Darrell Fuller, and I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Senate Bill 826 is a bill that we requested, and you should have dash one amendments in your packets. The dash one amendments are amendments that we requested that replace the bill. They include the substance of Senate Bill 826 with some changes, and the substance of Senate Bill 827, which is also in this committee, combines the two similar bills into a single bill. It is a negotiated compromise between auto dealers and auto manufacturers, heavy truck dealers and heavy truck manufacturers. It modifies our franchise law that we had since 1980. It essentially provides the guidelines for when a manufacturer can sell directly to consumers outside of the franchise system. Provides exceptions for when manufacturers can sell direct to consumers outside of the franchise system. It grandfathers in existing manufactured-owned retail facilities. And the bill comes to you as amended without opposition, and I would be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from the committee?
I don't know yet.
Don't know yet?
Mr. Chair, it might be easier, thank you, it might be easier for you to just explain what it means on page 3 of the amendment and number 11, why you're eliminating all of this mileage stuff and...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Melissa Anderson, if you look on page 4, it's actually added back in again. We restructured it. The relevant market area is essentially the area of sales and service, the minimum sales and service responsibility area for a dealer, and it's 10, 15, or 20 miles based on the population density for auto dealers. We had a new section in there for heavy truck manufactured dealers of a minimum of 25 miles because there are so many fewer heavy truck dealers in the state that their areas of sales and service responsibility are substantially larger. So you wouldn't have a case where in a city for, like Eugene, for example, where you'd have two Freightliner dealers. A Freightliner dealer in Eugene would probably cover most of a congressional district, as opposed to in a city of, like Portland, for example, you may have 10 Ford stores, and you'd only have one Peterbilt truck dealership because it's just a smaller market in terms of consumers buying that kind of product. So we simply add a new definition for heavy truck sales and service responsibility area. And why LC took it out of one area and re-added it someplace else in the definition sections, I'm not sure, but I imagine they had a good reason for doing it.
Follow up. Why do you need this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Modus Anderson, the 48 states have franchise laws. Franchise laws. And as we heard a franchise bill earlier this session in this committee that dealt with manufacturers other than auto dealers. But we are in a position where we have an agreement with the manufacturers to sell their product. And that agreement is called a franchise. And the example that I used earlier in this session is a franchise agreement is somewhat akin to the agreement you get with a credit card when you get issued a credit card. And that is you get this long agreement that says if you use our credit card, you agree to all these terms. It's not a negotiated contract between you and the credit card company. If you use their credit card, you have to agree to their terms. Well, for a motor vehicle dealer, it's much the same with a manufacturer like Ford. We simply agree to the terms in the franchise agreement they give us. And if we don't like the terms of the franchise agreement, well, we can just stop selling Fords. But if you're a third-generation Ford dealer, and all of a sudden they put something in the franchise agreement that is... would have a negative impact on your substantial negative impact on your dealership, we have no choice but to accept those terms unless there's a state statute that prohibits the manufacturer from doing certain things. So the franchise law is not unlike, another analogy, I guess, would be a constitution. The Constitution of the State of Oregon says what the legislature can and can't do with regard to state laws. Franchise law essentially establishes the parameters of what is permitted or not permitted in the franchise agreement between the dealer and the manufacturer.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And this means that, this isn't ordinarily covered then in regular contracts. I mean, I'm just wondering why it has to be in statute, why you can't just have contract language.
Mr. Chairman, I represent Mo Sanderson. The reason why is because the industry is so specific in terms of the type of product we have, whether it be warranty repairs. There are not too many other retail products that are of this value, where you're dealing with massive recalls, for example. I gave an example in an earlier hearing where in auto dealers, for example, there are more motor vehicles recalled by manufacturers every year than are sold by dealers in terms of new cars. So there are just specific parts of our industry that you couldn't put a generic franchise law to cover everybody, just because so many different manufacturing sectors are so specific in terms of the type of product they sell.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Fuller, under the designation of trucks, are motorhomes also covered under this prospective
law? Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, no, they are not. There's a specific definition of motorhomes in the statute, and motorhome dealers are exempted from the franchise law.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else who would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 826? If not, I will close the public hearing and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 826. Representative Canope?
Dash one amendments?
Mm-hmm. Dash one amendments.
Move dash one amendments to Senate Bill 826?
A. Representative
Canope
moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 826A. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Representative Canope?
Non ingress bill?
All right, Senate Bill 826. Okay. The dash one amendments to Senate Bill 826 are adopted. Representative Canope?
Hey, Mr. Chair. Before we do that, I think I'd like to call Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Fuller, can you come back, please?
Do I have counsel with me?
I think you're going to need them.
You have amendments on this side. Was there a reason they weren't offered on the other side?
We were still in, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knope, we were still in the negotiating process. Senate Bill 826 deals primarily with heavy trucks. Senate Bill 827, which is amended into 826, we finished the negotiations on 827 over on the Senate side, so we essentially didn't change the substance of 827A. We were still negotiating with Freightliner, but their chief legal counsel was undergoing chemotherapy when it was on the House side. He wasn't aware of the bill until, or on the Senate side, and he wasn't aware of the bill that came over here, and so we kind of put a pause on it until he was back in the office and working.
Is the Senate chair of the business committee aware of the amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knope, yes, he is.
Good enough. Mr. Chair.
Representative Knope.
I would move Senate Bill 826 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Before he leaves.
Representative Knope has moved Senate Bill 826 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. Would there be any opposition to this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Monis Anderson, we've worked everybody who has an interest in the bill, and there's no opposition to the bill we're aware of.
And Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
The staff measure summary says there's no revenue or fiscal on the basic bill. Do the amendments change the status of the fiscal and revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, no.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller, you said there was no opposition to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, there's no industry opposition to the bill that we're aware of.
Okay. Why is it in this committee?
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, that was not in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I decline to answer on the condition.
We probably could create some controversy.
Mr. Chairman, that'd not be my preference.
You'd like to do an economic analysis of these provisions and what impacts it has on market distribution and competition in the relevant market?
Mr. Chairman, good bill should pass.
You can take your seat now. Okay, we have a motion in front of us to move Senate Bill 826 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? I'm going to support this bill because I think this bill offers very reasonable and very necessary continued protection to automobile dealers in this state. Representative Monis Anderson asked some questions about, well, why do you need this? Why can't you do it by contract? Well, imagine a situation where you've been selling Ford or Chevy or Acura for 10, 15, 20 years, and your name is linked with that product. You've spent millions of dollars advertising that product. Your customer base is based on that product. Your service base is based upon that product. Your people are trained in that product, both from a service and a sales and administrative standpoint. And then a multi-billion dollar company comes to you and says, well, you know, thanks for the good job, but we're going to put in our own retail store up the street, and you've got 60 days to close out your sales. And by the way, those cars that you were for need to be paid off in the next 30 days. I mean, the reality of it is the kind of investments that are made to market these products are enormous. And without some kind of statutory protection, such as the auto dealers have, I think, very effectively and very appropriately carved out, not just in Oregon, but virtually all the states around the United States, it protects local business people and those investments. So I think this is a good bill, and it's a bill that's pretty similar to what we've had in statute here, and I'm very pleased to support it. Any other discussion? If not, Dan, please call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Girard.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canoe.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye. Senate Bill 826, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Knope will move the bill.
Okay.
We'll carry the bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 826. What do we do? What you want? Are we ready for 30? Are we ready for 35?
Yes.
Okay. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3502. Gary, do you want to come up? I think you have. Dan, we've heard this bill, Dan, right? And there's some amendments, I think, that have been offered.
We have. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, please take a look at the staff measure summary. In fact, House Bill 3502 has a dash one and a dash two amendment. The dash two incorporates the dash one amendments, and it also adds, or in fact rewords, fair and reasonable rates statement to require the PUC to balance the interests of the utility investor and the consumer. And as I understand, the proponent recommends adoption of the dash two amendment. I do not have revenue or fiscal impacts on anything other than the basic bill.
Okay.
Thank
Gary,
you.
Do you want to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. Sitting with me also is Mr. Mark Hellman of the Public Utility Commission. And we have agreed to offer joint testimony, which is in front of you. If you will allow me, there are a couple paragraphs I would like to read. We did spend a lot of time trying to clarify exactly what we mean by the amendments. And so if you would indulge me to do this. We both support the dash two amendments. The language is the result of several discussions between Northwest Natural and the commission. They help clarify that in establishing rates, the appropriate standard is the Hope decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. This standard is the legal standard regarding the setting of utility customer rates that governs commission decisions today. The dash two amendments insert and track the Hope language, the Supreme Court language, so as to ensure that Oregon law has a clear standard for establishing rates for regulated utilities. We've made minor changes in the language to modernize it and put it in the style that's used here in Oregon in terms of legislation. But we do not intend by any of these changes to alter the HOPE standard or the Commission's continued application of the standard. And if I can just go on for another minute, the dash two amendments make clear that when setting customer rates, the commission should protect customers of utility services and should also consider the needs of utilities to attract the financial capital necessary to provide adequate service to customers today, tomorrow, and in the future. Oregon utilities must compete for financial capital with companies of comparable risks. Those companies could include utilities in other states, and these companies also compete for financial capital in markets that are national and international in scope. The commission's role is thus to balance the needs of consumers and utilities in setting rates. I do want to add a note for the last paragraph, and that is that the commission sets rates on a forward-looking basis, and nothing in these amendments should be interpreted as to require the commission to go back and adjust past rates. And if a company wants to do that, they need to file a new rate proceeding and go through a new process. Mark, do you want to add anything?
Mr. Hellman, do you want to add?
Mark Hellman of Public Utility Commission. If it's permissible, I just wanted to add that the commission would say that there is no fiscal impact on this bill. It's not doesn't reflect any change in language that would cause a fiscal impact on the agency.
Okay. Questions for either of the witnesses, Representative Bates?
Mr. Bauer, you know, you may not have noticed, but we've got some questions going on about deregulation right now in electric industry. That's probably a big surprise to you, but I'm of the mind, and always have been, that that the production and distribution of electrical energy is really a monopoly and has to be looked at as a monopoly and regulated for the public good. Others feel that it is best left to the open market, and the demands of supply and demand and the open market will lead to good rates and good production. I don't have to believe that. On the other hand, I've looked and watched the last 10 years at the PUC as kind of laid out a situation, as I see it, that you can build a plant and we may or may not use your electrical power and we may or may not give you enough of a rate to recover your huge capital expenditures during that time. As I read this bill, the question I'm getting to here is, I read this bill, does this allow you to, if you're in a regulated market or even an unregulated market, to have some assurance you could build a plant and that you would get a reasonable return on your investments, that you would go forward and build that capacity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, always reluctant to enter into the electric dereg discussion. And Mr. Hellman is here, so he can correct me if he has a different view on this, but the HOPE standard is the standard that utility commissions are to follow today. The reason we brought the original legislation was at times there's a debate over how that discussion has carried out in proceedings. What we're doing here is clarifying that the HOPE standard is that standard that will be used. It clarifies that it puts it in Oregon law so people don't have to go back and try to argue against a U.S. Supreme Court case. I can't tell you that it will guarantee a change in rates or in any kind of a capital setting. That whole debate will be held in front of the PUC. Mr. Hill?
Okay. Did you want to add something?
Mark Hellman, PUC. My impression is that we're talking about two different issues. One issue is, on an expected basis, should the companies have rates sufficient to allow them to provide returns to investors that are required? And the answer to that question is yes. The question I thought you were asking is there any assurance if a utility were to make an investment in an asset, some kind of venture, would they know that they would get that investment included in rates? And I think the answer to that is no, but there are a number of different procedures that the commission uses to reduce the level of those kinds of risks. One is that there are least cost plans that all the companies go to that identify resources or facilities that appear to be the least cost way of providing services to consumers. And through that process, while it's not a guarantee, the commission is acknowledging that this plan looks like a good deal. the commission and a number of parties are discussing this kind of issue on the side to see what more it is that we can do and whether there are some other kinds of legislation that could help in this regard. Those discussions are ongoing. I don't know if we'll be able to reach agreement for legislation this session. That certainly is my hope. But I think we're talking about two different issues. One is in general, and another one's more of if a certain investment's built, what kind of insurance can a company have that that investment itself can be recovered in rates?
Oh, Mr. Chair, follow up. Just real quickly, I didn't expect this bill to completely answer that question. The question I'm asking is, does it make it more likely or make it somewhat easier for a utility or an independent power producer to build a plant? I mean, the problem we're facing right now is lack of capacity, and part of the reason we have lack of capacity is a lack of incentive for people to take the risk of building those plants. Does this bill in any way address that problem?
Chair? I don't believe that this bill is addressing that issue. If we're talking about independent power producers, the commission does not regulate them, does not set rates, does not have anything to do with guaranteeing their return. What the commission does try and do is make sure that the market structure, at least what it has control over, facilitates fair and open competition. But if we're talking about independent power generator, it's up to them to make a go of it and hopefully make a return such that their investment is recovered.
Certainly, Mr. Hellman, isn't it true that to the extent that a regulated utility cannot provide the kind of rate of return for investors that's necessary to attract sufficient capital, that utility will not have sufficient capacity to provide the power that is necessary in a situation of growing demand? And that could have the effect of raising rates over the long term because you have a supply-demand imbalance.
Yes, I would agree with that, and I think that's one of the things that this bill does address by incorporating the HOPE standard so that there is no misunderstanding as to what the commission's current practice is, and that would continue.
Finally, on the dash twos on line 1415, it says a return to equity, the equity holder, that is, a commensurate with the return on investments in other enterprises having corresponding risks. Is the language there mean both regulated and non-regulated business enterprises?
Yes, it does.
It does. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Walker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bauer, has this been prompted by anything that's happened with deregulation or restructuring, Senate Bill 1149?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, no, this was actually prompted on some discussions and debates we had as a part of our last rate case, and in our testimony. Following from that, we had discussions from the investment community regarding the setting of rates and how things are looked at in the capital markets. As a result of all that, and based on our discussions with the commission, we're putting in statute this U.S. Supreme Court decision, which does clarify that the commission balances customer and investor interests, they do look out both near-term as well as long-term, and they do look both locally and nationally when they're looking at equity issues.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else who would like to provide testimony on House Bill 3502 or the dash two amendments? We're in work session. Yeah, we're in work session. The chair will entertain a motion on the dash two amendments.
Chair, I move the dash two amendments. House Bill 3502.
Representative Knope moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3502. Is there any objection? Seeing none, ordered. Representative Knope.
I move House Bill 3502 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Knope moves House Bill 3502 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I'm pleased they were able to come to a language that satisfies both the PUC and Northwest Natural on this. I do think that customers here in Oregon have a real legitimate need and concern to make sure that there's a sufficient rate of return on investments for regulated companies such as Northwest Natural, because if there isn't, they have trouble attracting capital. We won't have the power, the natural gas in this case, that our state needs and our residents need over the long term to be able to keep, not only keep prices down, but also meet the demand that comes from a growing economy. So I think this bill is a positive step forward, and I appreciate the cooperation that the Public Utility Commission gave to try to resolve the differences in the initial language. And I think we have a good product going forward that's going to be helpful to our state. Any other discussion? Dan, please call the roll.
Representative Bates?
No.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Canope?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 3502, as amended, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3502.
Mr. Chair, I'm serving notice of possible minority report.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm joining Representative Bates in that.
Okay, noted. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2841 and invite Representative Smith to come forward. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Smith, and I'm the state representative for District 59 in rural eastern Oregon. I've asked Mr. Mike Burton from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to sit beside me for technical expertise. I'm bringing forward a bill that is relatively simple, but it's very important to folks in rural eastern Oregon and rural Oregon for that matter, and that's House Bill 2841. This is a bill that allows certain regional boards to retain regional and rural investment funds beyond the biennium in which the funds were provided. And I understand that there's also been an amendment that is going to be introduced to this bill. The reason I bring this bill forward is the eight county judges whom I represent in eastern Oregon contacted me and said, Greg, we have a problem. We're trying to do some long-term strategic planning. We're trying to put together some long-term capital improvement projects. And the way the current statutes reads, our communities have to spend their money in the biennium in which it's given. And what this is doing is forcing these regional partnerships to rush their economic development plans and to move forward in a way that perhaps is unwise. And that's why I'm bringing this bill forward today, and that is to overcome the funding time constraints and to allow better organized planning and strategizing in areas such as rural eastern Oregon, so they'll have the necessary time to make the economic development decisions that they need. This will benefit the regional partnerships that have been established through statute. This will serve our rural counties and our rural communities. I think it's a simple bill makes sense. So.
And Representative, you'd like the Dash 1 amendments as well?
I've had a chance to look through those, and these work better than the original bill, and so I can concur with those.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Representative Smith? Representative Brock?
Representative Smith, I'm well aware of the problem that this bill addresses. Are you placing any kind of time frame in which those funds have to be expended?
Chair Witt, Representative Girard, I would turn to.
Mr. Burton.
Chair Witt, Representative Girard. The point of this bill is to identify the activity of consciously, intentionally setting the part of the resource aside as an activity so that it qualifies within the current statute as an allowable use. The folks that Greg's referring to, Representative Smith is referring to, at our suggestion, are trying to be more deliberate and strategic in their approach, and the current process
makes a race to the finish line of June 30th. This bill says, if your intention is to take that money and use it for some future purpose that's defined within your plan and acknowledged within your plan, that counts as an activity, and therefore, they meet the requirement of having used it within the budget, the existing requirement of having used it within the budget. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Burton or Representative Smith, I'm not sure I heard an answer. Are there sidebars on the timeline?
Chair Whip, Representative Johnson, there continue to be sidebars on the timeline, and that is the end of the biennium, but setting the money in an account for future accomplishments, continuing projects that have already begun, things like that, investing it to utilize the proceeds is counted as an activity that would meet the requirement of using the money within the current biennium.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Let me try to ask this a different way. Would you foresee a region being able to accumulate grants biennium after biennium and amalgamate those grants to then deal with one large project? Let's say there's a very significant infrastructure project, a sewer project, so that they might get $300,000 in biennium one, $300,000 in biennium two, and that they would be able to accumulate those over the course of maybe four biennia towards getting the $1 million necessary to do the sewer project.
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, my understanding is that is precisely the intent of the Lower John Day region, which is responsible for this, and this bill would allow that.
Okay. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
12 biennia have now gone by. How much longer until somebody does something with the money?
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, it is my belief that local pressures will ultimately provide more than enough impetus for regions to invest the money very actively. Even the Lower John Day is making decisions given those local pressures to make investments. I don't see anybody holding the resource for 12 biennia or two biennia.
Would the Lower John Day be penalized in that they were continuing to accumulate money towards a project? I would hate to see them accumulating multiple biennia grants towards Project A and not considered for funding for Project B because they had a fund with a cash balance in it. Have you thought through your internal processes at the department to prevent against being stigmatized for accumulating in for Project A and not qualifying for others?
I'd like to answer that, Chair Witt, Representative Johnson. I would hope that this body, particularly the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Economic Development and Transportation, would look at that and ask that question of that partnership and say, why are you accumulating that money? And then as a committee, we would have to decide, you and I who serve on that, if that's a good use of state resources to allow it to accumulate.
Regrettably, though, Representative Smith, it's my observation that the legislature does not participate in the listings of grants that are either fundable grants immediately or in the pipeline grants. And my concern is to not have your region or any other region that is subject to this bill stigmatized for possible other grants if you are accumulating biennium to biennium money, right, towards a single project. I would hate to have somebody say, well, they've got a cash balance and have that accrue against getting other awards for other projects because you were accumulating money towards a single large major investment infrastructure project.
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, I think there would be tremendous pressure, as Mike pointed out, for these regional investment boards to use that money rather than just letting it accumulate. And so I think there would have to be a very well thought out plan and rationale for why they would be investing that money for a future project.
And Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, if I may add to that answer, that's a valid concern. We've already had several conversations with the regional partnership
and the county judges in the lower John Day region to clarify what they intend to use the money that they would like to accumulate for, and to help us understand which of the elements of work that need to be undertaken in the region are not addressed by that, so that we may act in concert with them to address those needs that are not being addressed by their reserving this money.
And then Chair Witt, members of the committee, what I would add is the reason, that I brought this bill forward is in rural Oregon, many times these folks are using these dollars as seed money for rural investment projects, perhaps with the federal government through rural development or with EDA, and many times that grant application process is quite lengthy. And so when I put this together, my original intent was to allow these investment boards to make that commitment and then allow these small communities to go out and to pursue those dollars and know that that money would be there when they did receive the award.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not entirely familiar with how the department's budget works, and so I just have a few clarifying questions. Are the dollars that we're talking about held at the state level in a treasury account and then released upon request, or are the dollars actually distributed to a local level and held at the local level?
Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, the amount allocated to the regional and rural investment programs are distributed quarterly when the department receives its quarterly lottery disbursement. So they are held at the local level.
They're held at the local level. Follow up, Mr. Chair? Is the local level allowed to accrue interest then on those accounts?
Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, yes.
Okay. One more follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Are there financial reports that have to be given in the interim, or are they simply required to report when upon completion of a project?
Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, at the current time, we require annual reports, and the timing of those reports in September. At that time, the intention is that we'll have the reports and can put the information together to report it back to the Legislative Assembly. So they do report annually on projects, activities, and there's also a requirement for a biennial update of the two-year implementation plan. I came prepared to speak to what the programs are about and can do that. I did pass out a packet of information that came from our Ways and Means Subcommittee presentation. I don't want to take a lot of your time, so if I don't need to do that, I won't, but I'd be happy to do a little bit of that and answer further questions about programmatic functions.
I just had one more follow-up question, sure. Mr. Chair. Has the department adopted administrative rules with regard to how dollars flow and that type of thing? And if this statute were passed, would probably be adopting additional administrative rules about extending funding? And I guess this part B of that question would be, who would participate in that process if the answer is yes?
Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, the Dash 1 amendments allow us to accomplish the end that Representative Smith's region is seeking without otherwise changing the statute or our administrative rules.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm still having a little problem in that I've been the chair of these regional partnerships and people change, et cetera, et cetera. I'm having a little problem with sticking the money someplace in a regional partnership bank account and letting it sit there with no accountability apparently to anybody other than the participating counties or the partnership itself. Now, the partnerships themselves are now under question as to whether they will be continuing. I'm wondering if maybe an amendment that says that you hold the money until the project becomes in an active, we were talking about an active status, and then is released as needed during the project. Rather than turning this money over, giving the interest, giving everything, and I'm just afraid, I know how some of these work, that the money could get lost as far as accountability is concerned.
Chair Witt, Representative Gerard, one other perhaps option is just to allow an additional biennium, and then whatever money is not spent at that time would be returned back. What we're trying to do with the Lower John Day partnership is we've got these investment projects going on, and they're using rural development dollars and EDA dollars. And these applications, as you know, can take anywhere between 12 months and 36 months to complete. And what they want to be able to do in their application is say, we've put down $100,000 of seed money as their contribution to the project, and then go make application. The dilemma is they put the seed money down, the time comes and goes, and that money's still sitting there. Right. And these communities then are being forced to spend the money in ways that perhaps isn't the most strategic.
Chair Witt, Representative Gard, if I might follow up on that again. I meant to suggest, and maybe I didn't do a good job in answering Representative Carlson, that we do require reports. Until the money is spent, the projects are completed, and the outcomes that are intended are accomplished or not, the project is done and the results are known, the regions are required to report the whereabouts and the status of that money to the department.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
However, I know some of these projects can be funded. I mean, we're talking $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. Now, if I were a regional partnership that was looking at a project, I might like to have the interest off that $200,000-$300,000 for 4 years to go into my kitty to help me with other things. And I don't see anything in the bill that says where the interest money is going. So.
Chair Witt, Representative Garrard, I believe that the statute already, all of the regions currently use interest earnings within the program. I believe the statute, I can't tell you where it is, but I believe the statute already addresses that and requires that program income, which would be interest and recaptured principal on loan, revolving loan funds and the like, be continued to be used in the program for the programmatic purposes, consistent with the plan that the partnership has at given time and consistent with statute.
Follow up quickly. So in essence, your office is really holds the regional partnership accountable for that money, and you do monitor where it is.
Chair Witt, Representative Bird, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of this, and correct me again if I'm wrong, is that this gives you an opportunity to not fall into the usual common government game of either use it or lose it. It allows you just to focus that money on possibly bigger projects. I've been in the last 10 years, I've been in a strange position of asking for block grants from the federal government, and they don't trust how we use it in Oregon because they feel we'll fritter away and the money will disappear. Now I find myself in the position of in the state government of looking at the same situation on the opposite side of the fence. And I'm not going to change my position. I think local control of these funds is the best control of these funds and try the best way to use. Agreed that it can't try and be misused, but we have some oversight, it appears, here. So I guess what my question to you is my summation of this correct? You're going to hold these funds. They're going to be watched. You're going to use them for larger projects. You will not be fritting them away just to get them used up so you don't lose them. And it allows you to focus your efforts in your rural communities. Is that a correct information?
Chair Witt, Representative Bates, that is accurate. In the interest of good public policy, I would not be bringing this bill forward if I thought I was going to be allowing our local governments to sit there on a large pot of money. My intent was to allow good projects that need time to mature and know that money's still going to be there. That was my intent, and that's why I brought the bill forward.
Mr. Chair?
Are you done, Representative Bates?
Yes.
So it's going to stay in an active status with your office and be monitored during the period of time that the partnership has the money. Thank you.
Chair Witt, if I could just add one more comment. One of the statements that was made was the pressure there is to use this money. The way the partnerships are formed are multiple counties come together and they compete for these dollars. And if one county has a large project that they're trying to put this money aside for, and that project does not look like it's going to come to fruition, I can tell you those other counties are going to be asking the question, why is that money just sitting there then, when I've got projects in my community that are ready to proceed and are ready to go? And so I think there's an internal mechanism in addition to what the state provides to make sure those dollars are moving forward.
So.
how many regions does this bill affect with the 50,000 inhabitants?
Chair Johnson, the Dash 1 amendments removed that, Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Johnson, the Dash 1 amendments removed that population threshold. And basically, so they do continue to require that there be a partnership. There are 6 partnerships around the state currently.
So any of them are now eligible to apply the strictures of this bill? Okay.
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, it is my experience that nobody holds the money, that there is. My most glaring experience is when I transferred to the Benton Lane, Lincoln Lynn region on the first week in August, the first August of a biennium, so what, 35 days into a biennium, was the deadline for the request for proposals by that regional board, and at their next meeting they spent all of the money. So less than 2 months into the biennium they spent all the money. That's more typical than anybody wanting to put the money aside and allow it to wait until the project matures.
My only observation, I guess, would be that the regional boards might profit from some education, that they have the opportunity to now amalgamate grants over multiple years, because it's my observation that in this use-it-or-lose-it environment that exists right now, some kind of questionable projects get done, and I know the benefit of picking these projects at the local level is so you get input, but it pains me to see funds expended to paint murals on walls when sewers are crumbling. And so I renew the observation that I've made in the Ways and Means process with you guys' budget, that I hope somewhere someone sits down with these boards and explains to them what a new opportunity is now available in terms of accumulating funds for larger projects.
Chair Witt, Representative Johnson, if I may, I've been telling people they need to slow down and take it easy. The response that I got about a year ago was, then why do you have a deadline on when we spend the money? If you want us to be careful and take our time and choose good projects, get rid of the deadline. That's why the department supports this bill.
Representative Devlin, is your hand up?
No,
I just had one more question. I noticed in my notes that Judge Laura Pryor was here to speak on this bill on the 27th of April. Is she aware of these changes with these amendments, and does this meet the need that she talked about at that time?
Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, I would not be advocating for the amendments that I haven't checked with my local folks.
Thank you.
No. Chair Witt, Representative Carlson, she actually spoke to the amendments at the meeting and said she supported, or at the hearing and said she supported them.
Great. Thank you.
I don't think Representative Smith wants to get in trouble with the judge.
No, nope,
just checking.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
We're in a public hearing. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you. Anybody else would like to provide testimony to the committee today on House Bill 2841? If not, I will close the public hearing and I will open a work session. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2841.
Thank you. Representative Johnson moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2841. Is there any objection? If not so ordered, could you get Representative Smith for a minute, please, Mr. Burton? Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2841 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2841 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? All those questions, there's got to be some discussion.
Friday.
No discussion.
We're all discussing.
Okay, go ahead and call the roll then on the motion.
Representative Bates?
Excused, apparently.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Canope?
Excuse.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 2841 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Smith, you'll carry the bill, please?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I will close the work session on House Bill 2841, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3009. Okay, and Dan, can you bring us up to date? And I think we might have amendments on that bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3009. The dash one amendment that you should have replaces the original bill, and it grants to the PUC the ability to approve a natural gas utility rate for residential customers that includes funds for bill payment assistance to low-income residential customers. It limits those funds collected for low-income bill payment assistance to one-half of one percentile of the utility's gross revenues in sales to residential customers. It has no revenue impact or fiscal impact on the basic bill, and don't have that information yet on the dash one amendment.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bauer, would you like to start on this, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. Also with me is Ms. Susan Ackerman, who's manager of our Rates and Regulatory Department. We're appearing in support of the Dash 1 amendments. What these amendments do is completely strip the original bill and in its place insert language that will allow the Public Utility Commission to approve in rates a program that will allow us to assist low-income customers with energy assistance. This language is necessary because without it, the PUC cannot allow any changes or discrimination within a particular customer class. I don't want to go through all the testimony since I know it's Friday, and I've learned from past Fridays that that's not good. I would like to comment that we have been in discussions with the Public Utility Commission, the Citizens Utility Board, representatives of low-income customers and energy efficiency organizations about a proposal that we're in the process of trying to pull together and hope to sit down and begin more formal discussions with the PUC possibly later this month. This is part of that program, and it would allow us to assist low-income customers with their energy bills. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to, Ms. Ackerman, would you like to add anything? Mr. Bissonnette, would you like to give some testimony?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm here today representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Very briefly, I want to speak in support of the Dash 1 amendments. We have been in conversation with Northwest Natural and our low-income colleagues to try and figure out the solution to start to up the ante a little bit on low-income assistance in the natural gas field, no pun intended. I guess while we feel this is a good start, you know, it's not the be-all, end-all, but we're pleased to see this is moving in the right direction, and we're pleased to support it. And we do note that the amendments are voluntary, and Northwest Natural has committed to following through on a commitment to develop a program, and we hope that they're joined by others of their natural gas colleagues, and we'll be working with them as well to try and get them to do that. But we do urge the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments and to pass it out to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Bauer is aware of what question I'm going to ask. Why wasn't commercial customers also included in this?
Chair Witt, Representative Monis Anderson, Susan Ackerman. We wanted to keep the raising of funds within the class to whom it's going to assist. And there are rarely bill payment funds made available to commercial customers and other business customers, and we wanted to keep the classes that were getting the assistance to be responsible for raising the funds.
Follow-up. Is there much difference, I would think there is, but between rates for commercial and residential customers?
Yes, Chair Witt, Representative Monis Anderson, that's correct.
And which way is it?
residential rates tend to be the highest rates that customers pay. Residential, meaning that commercial rates will be much lower than residential rates.
But they're higher users.
Correct.
No further questions.
Other questions? Tell me, Mr. Bissonnette, you talked about a commitment made by Northwest Natural Gas, Northwest Natural on this. What can you tell me about that?
Chair Witt,
Northwest Natural, and they can obviously speak for themselves since they're here, but they entered into this discussion willing to see what they could do on both the low-income energy assistance and sort of a general natural gas public purposes program. They did not feel that under current law that they could go and ask for this in their tariff with the PUC, and so we felt that we needed to come to the legislature to grant that authority to the PUC. But if this bill passes, the PUC will have that authority, and Northwest Natural has given the indication that they will file a tariff to implement this program.
Okay. So this would ensure Northwest Natural, or it gives the authority to the PUC to approve a request for bill payment assistance, for low-income bill payment assistance.
Mr. Chair, Gary Bauer, yes, that's correct. It's triggered by the utility filing with the commission, and then the commission will hold a proceeding as they would any of their other regulatory proceedings to determine the public policy benefits about it. But
okay.
It does not require either party, but it is our intention.
It clearly grants the authority to the PUC to grant the request upon hearing, upon the request in the hearing.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. But it appears it grants the PUC the authority only if the utility applies. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to give any testimony on the Dash 1 amendments? Not, I will close and open the work session. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the Dash 1 to House Bill 3009.
Representative Johnson moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3009. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3009 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 3009 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Yeah, I think this is a good bill, and I think it makes clear to the PUC that upon the application, it is to have a hearing and, if appropriate, include it within the rate base, and I think it serves an important social purpose in terms of providing assistance to low-income Oregonians in terms of paying their heating bills. So I think it's a good bill. Look forward to it becoming law, hopefully. Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Canope?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 3009 as amended goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Johnson, would you carry this bill, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, I will close the work session on House Bill 3009, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3782. Dan, would you bring us up to date on that bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3782 has, in your packet, you should find a Dash 1 amendment, which replaces the original bill. The Dash 1 amendment establishes the car renter or lessee is the sole defendant in prosecution for a delinquent parking violation of a rental car if a court directs the car rental company to provide information on the renter or lessee. It dismisses a car rental company from any obligation or prosecution for a delinquent parking violation incurred by a renter or lessee if directed by a court to provide information on the renter or lessee. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Mr. Gardner, Mr. Alkins, and I guess Mr. Swank as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Hertz, Avis, Budget, Dollar, and several other national rental car companies. The Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3782 represent our effort to craft another tool in our ongoing effort to work with the judicial system and local government to get at the vexing problem of how to get people who rent cars to pay parking tickets, particularly when they live out of state, as many of them do. The history of this is that a couple of sessions ago, we were confronted with a situation where, in effect, the judicial department was not able to effectively pursue these folks and was just not following up at all on the parking tickets that people were getting when they were using rental cars. We crafted what we thought would be a workable legislative solution, which was a system whereby we would get notice within 30 days of the name and identity of the renter, and then we would put it on the credit card as an ancillary charge. And that seemed to be something that would work pretty well. But the problem was kind of twofold. First, often we would get the notification in bulk very close or right at the end of the 30-day period. And in the meantime, the renter had actually, a number of them had actually paid the tickets themselves. You had a kind of a double charge on the person that had rented the car. And then they would contest back to the credit card company, say, excuse me, I've already paid this, or they would write, ask for a refund to the local court, and it was an incredible snarl. So the philosophy of the Dash One Amendment is that, if possible, it's better to have the debt essentially tracked through a single system with a single collection entity. The Dash Ones were brought to us at the suggestion of Doug Bray, who is the Multnomah County, the administrator of the Multnomah County Judicial District.
He's the trial court administrator for Multnomah County.
And they believe that this is a permissive tool, unlike the original version of the bill, which gives them a tool. If they choose to utilize it, to put in place essentially a collection process in lieu of the credit card pass-through process, which they think and we think might work better. At least it gives an additional tool to try to get at this problem. City of Portland, Mr. Chair, should have passed. I think passed you a note indicating that they're in support of the Dash Ones.
They did,
and that and. So I don't think there's any opposition to it. And it does give us another way of trying to get at this problem.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Swank.
Chair Whip, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel for the State Court Administrator's Office for Government Relations. As the Dash One amendments before you for House Bill 3782 are consensus amendments that were worked out by a work group. Doug Bray, who's the trial court administrator for the Multnomah County Court, which is both the circuit court and the, for Multnomah County and that judicial district, and also the municipal court by statute for Portland, worked on these amendments. What the amendments do is create permissive language to allow them to try and work the problem out. It's an ongoing issue for both the city and the state as to the money that comes in and collecting that money from parking. When people park cars too long and they've got rented cars, so they're going to try and work the system out on a system thing. Your fiscal probably said that there's no fiscal on this. We actually talked today. These amendments will substantially reduce our fiscal from the original bill in terms of both lost revenue and operations costs. I can't say that they'll eliminate it, but I can say that we're working with Doug Bray. When I was talking to the legislative fiscal office this afternoon, they felt that it would probably eliminate it, lower it below the point where they were concerned about it, because it becomes permissive. There may be ongoing operations costs as they try to install this system and work out the problem. But we'll work with Doug Bray to try and figure out what those are and get your fiscal before it hits the court. I can answer any questions. They're consensus amendments. We don't believe there are any other problems with that. And we think if there's an ongoing problem, they should have enabling legislation to try and let them work out the problem.
So this fiscal showing $77,886.
The original fiscal, Chair Witt, members of the committee, the original fiscal showing $77,086 included a number of things in the original bill. That was a fiscal for operations costs that we thought it would cost us, because the work would be coming back and it would have to be rerun through the courts.
as I understand the process that they're contemplating working out, they're trying to work out a process where there will be an electronic transfer of information. And between the rental car companies and the courts and or the collections agencies that are operating for the courts, and they think that that will be able to cut down the operations costs. We may not have to send notices out again. That's how I understand they're intending to work this out.
I see. Okay. Mr. Alphons?
I have nothing to add. Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Chair. Questions? Representative Johnson?
Mr. Gardner, this can't be a problem isolated to Oregon. What happens in other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it varies. In Seattle, for instance, there is a system that uses a procedure very much like that which is contemplated in the Dash 1 amendments. In some other states, they have attempted to do the credit card pass-through and have encountered, you know, problems similar to what I've described. In some other states, there will simply be the ticket will be issued, and if the money is not paid, they'll just write it off and ignore it. So there's a variety of approaches that are taken.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And by the way, I will read to the committee a note I got from Susan Schneider, City of Portland, this afternoon, where she said she couldn't be here, but we have worked out amendments with rental car companies and court, and we are fine with the amendments. Because I know they had a concern on the bill in its original form. Okay, is anybody else who would like to give testimony on House Bill 3782? Apparently not. I will close the public hearing. I'll open a work session. The chair will entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Chair, I'd move a Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3782.
Representative Knope moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3782. Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Knope.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3782 as amended to the floor with two pass recommendation.
Representative Knope moves House Bill 3782 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wood?
Aye. House Bill 3782, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Girard, would you please carry this bill? Thank you. Okay, we'll close the work session. Is there anything else this evening for the committee? Dan has an announcement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today, those of you not on the Revenue Committee, your assistant should be in possession now of the volumes 1 and 2 of the Safe Workers' Compensation Report for your weekend pleasure.
Oh, okay, thank you.
It looks like more than volume 1 and 2, Mr. Clinton.
Yeah, volume 2, I think, is in several different binders. So.
Okay, is there anything else?
I have 2 cents.
Okay, if not, thank you, everybody, for working so efficiently this afternoon, and have a nice weekend. Don't forget to return.
Happy weekend, Reed.
When I was in Salem, I don't want to drive home. I just want to see you.